This is the Meek Informant, your content source for Legend of the Five Rings, published by Fantasy Flight Games. Enjoy the show. Welcome, everybody, to your podcast for the Meek and Uninformed. I'm Adam, and I am joined tonight with Eric and two other guests. Eric, why don't you say hi and let us know who else is with us.
Hey, everybody. It's Eric. We're continuing our series on the Clan Champion interview series, and today we're going to be talking about Dragon. And we've encountered the first time now in these Clan Champion interview things where we have a clan that has more than one viable deck. And two pretty distinct deck archetypes exist within the Dragon Clan, which is the clan that we're going to be talking about today. So we decided to reach out to a couple different people, and each one of them is going to represent, I guess, or at least, you know, act as the ambassador for each of these two types of deck archetypes.
People who have taken these decks and executed them in various locations, proven that they know how to pilot them. And whether or not they are the deck they invented or the deck that they are, you know, championing, it's going to be nice to have a little bit of varied discussion on this from other people that are kind of, I'll call them dragon experts, for those deck archetypes. So we have Arash and we have Alex here joining us. So why don't you guys introduce Arash? Why don't you go ahead first and say hi?
Hey. Oh, sorry. Hi.
Hi, yes, this is legally binding. Anything I say that you must say, you have to also say. You are a dragon player, so you have to follow, you know, all lines of play that someone else tells you, right?
That sounds great. That makes me feel very comfortable. Please continue doing that.
All right, Alex, and why don't you say hi as well and tell us a little bit about yourself, Alex, and then we'll go back to Arash.
Hi, new friends. My name's Alex. I'm one of the Dragon Hatamoto, along with Arash. And I'm here to talk to you about one of the dragon decks.
And I'm Arash, also here to talk to you about the monk deck.
Right. So Alex, you have a bunch of experience, as far as I understand, with dueling within Dragon. And recently, like, I have this correct? You've been dueling since before the Daisho came out, right? That was like your whole thing for a while.
I've been running dueling since Core. I took it to the first Worlds. I took it to PAX Unplugged in 2017, where I got my Hatamoto, made the top 16 with it. I thought it was a very strong deck, and it got very overshadowed when the Crab/Monk deck really took off, which I want to be clear here was the stronger deck. But dueling has always been viable, and now we just have a lot more tools to play around with it.
I actually played once my monk deck versus his old dueling deck. It was in the Discord League pod game.
That's going back really far. I don't remember how that one wound up. That must have been like season 8 or 9.
It was something like that. I think I won, and I remember at the time you were like, this deck has a 75% win rate against Standard Dragon. And I was like, oh.
Well, you are not a Standard Dragon.
But yeah, so no, you've been running that deck for a really long time.
Alex, you wrote the dueling article for Imperial Advisor, didn't you?
I did. So leading up to Children, when FFG was giving preview articles and talking about how there was going to be more support for dueling and more things going with the honor bit, I was just chomping at the bit. I was really excited to see what was going to come out. And there was about a 2-week window when it dropped where I had an advantage because I had all this experience with dueling where most players were just getting used to the mechanics of it. That was one of the reasons why the deck did as well for me as it did. It's like if you're a left-handed fencer, you have an advantage because most opponents are right-handed. They're not used to facing a left-handed fencer, whereas you're used to facing right-handed all the time. So for them, they were always jumping to a weird situation. And for me, it was my normal thing. But when Children came out and there was all this interest in it, I wanted to help share some of that information. So I worked with Baz. He actually was one of the best editors I've ever worked with, who really helped me focus the article, hone in on topics, and say, this is how dueling works. These are the mechanics of it. This is the psychology of it. And this is what you want to do to take advantage of it, whether you're running it or whether you're facing someone else who is running it.
Yeah, that's great. We're definitely going to put a link to that article in the show notes to this episode, because it's really useful information for a new player who, you know, is just getting used to dueling. Maybe. So let's take a step back, because we're talking about how you're doing this distinct deck versus this other deck that Arash is playing, and a lot of Dragon players are playing. But we need to take a step back, because the whole focus of these interviews are talking with someone who's really good with the clan, with the eye of, or to the audience of new players who might not know what's going on. So they might not have any idea what we're talking about with this monk deck. So we're going to get to that in a second. But first, I want to just ask you guys, you know, quickly, how did you each get into L5R? Arash, can you tell us?
Yeah, sure. So I've been gaming for most of my life, I guess, or for a long time. And I used to play a lot of mini games, but I played this game Malifaux, and then that sort of like was on the outs. And I needed something to fill in the void, and I started playing Destiny, which is the other like FFG CCG. And that was around when the first Gen Con where L5R came out, and a lot of people were super hyped about it. And I realized that Destiny was going to waste so much of my money, and LCGs were not going to, so I started playing L5R. And that's actually when Adam started getting into L5R too, right?
Yeah, yeah, I think it was when it came out at Gen Con, I got excited to play. And, you know, you and I have a long history of playing Malifaux together. And I think because of the Brooklyn crew there that you play with, it was an easy transition. You had a play group, I had a play group up here.
Like all of them switched over to L5R.
Yeah, and so like we would show up to these miniatures tournaments and then play those miniature tournaments and then be like, okay, let's go play L5R.
I think I actually skipped around and played L5R instead.
Yeah, I guess for you and I, like I think the draw was it was a competitive game. It did not require miniatures, even though you're an amazing miniatures painter. I enjoy painting miniatures.
I think you're really good too.
Yeah, thank you. But I think also like we got to play a competitive game with the people that we already played competitive games with. And I think for us, it was an easy, like for anybody who doesn't know Malifaux, and I don't want to speak for your rush here, but like I think anybody who doesn't play Malifaux, it's a very intricate game, just like L5R is. So I think for us, it gave us that same complexity and, you know, excitement.
Yeah, it definitely scratches the same itch. And it was a very like natural transition. And actually, then it just became my main game. And now it's basically the only game that I play outside of like Blood Bowl, which is not that serious a game.
All right. So I guess, Alex, what about you? So did you play old L5Rs? Are you just a new L5R player? When did you get into playing?
My history was actually very kind of twisted. I got started in academia. My sophomore year of college, I was taking a Japanese literature course. And ended up writing my final paper on Rokugan as an American interpretation of Japanese film and literary archetypes. Very pretentious sounding paper. I got a C+ on it, so it wasn't very good. But that introduced me to the setting. And then my senior year of college, two people in my college's sci-fi club started up an L5R LARP. So I joined that. And then when I graduated, I moved to Madison, Wisconsin. I knew two people in about a 1-hour radius. But there's this great thing about gamers. If you find a gaming community, then you have all these people to play with. It's a very easy way to build a social circle. So I put up a flyer in one of the local game shops, said I like L5Rs, anyone want to teach me the card game? And my L5R mentor, a guy named Eric Pfefferly, found me and he taught me to play the cards. I did that for a couple years. I dropped the CCG in about 2007 for financial reasons. It was very expensive to keep up with the decks. And I didn't have a local community anymore. Since I'd moved. But what was really the intervening decade, very active in the role-playing community, doing a lot of tabletop RPGs. And when FFG announced the LCG, I thought that works for me financially. I love the setting. I'd like to spend more time there. So I jumped in, was not expecting to be that great of a player because I considered myself primarily a role player. But apparently I'm somewhat decent at it.
And humble too. how did you come across the game to the point where you were familiar enough with Rokugan to write a big paper on it? So how did you discover that?
Well, that goes back to D&D. D&D was my first RPG, as it was for most people. I started playing about a month after third edition launched. So that was, I want to say, 99, 2000, around there. And they were really hyping up the Oriental Adventures source book that was coming out. And when that launched, I got the book, read it cover to cover, and there was a partnership between Wizards of the Coast and AEG,
right,
where they used Rokugan as the default setting to explain most of the things in the book.
Yeah, I'd heard about that. It's interesting. There's a lot of crossover between the RPG and LCG. Adam and I did the intro scenario to the RPG. I'm not a huge fan, it turns out, in the end, but it's awesome. It's great that everybody gets into it.
Whereas I'm obsessed with it. I've been reading the new Shadowlands book that came out by FFG this past couple.
I love the lore. I just, something about role-playing and me don't get along, but to each their own. And, you know, more power.
There's a lot of fans of the card game who buy the RPG books just to keep up with the lore.
Yeah, they are.
Those are beautiful books. I really like them.
There was, a quick side note is I was thumbing through the Shadowlands book today. I was reading it, but I was thumbing through some pages I hadn't got to yet. There's a page about Maho in there. And they have this page on the right that has somebody like, you know, I don't know, flaring up a fire or something like that. But on the left page is just this little like ember yellow. And it's like, that just got me. I was just like, this is so cool the way they just do those books. The books are beautiful.
This whole game, the artwork in this game, it's great. You know, the story and how they all mesh together. So how did you guys end up landing on being a dragon player?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So when I first started playing the game, I actually liked purple. So I thought that I'd play unicorn.
Just as a color?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. As a primary, like, is it a primary color? I don't know. But
plus, you had like amazing playmats for it that matched like really well.
That's true. But after playing them, I didn't really, I mean, they just sucked. They're just so bad. And then I started playing Scorpion, but around like Imperial Cycle, Scorpion was kind of NPE in my opinion. And I was like running a lot of events and all that stuff in my community, and I felt as though like I don't want to, like, if I'm like the tournament organizer here, I probably shouldn't be playing this deck that's just like very, very good and like stomps people. So there was no one playing dragon. So I was like, okay, I will play dragon. Also, I like dragons. So that is how I started playing dragon. That is not a, like a very awe-inspiring story.
That's basically the same way that I ended up on dragon. There was nobody in my store that was playing dragon. So I said, oh, okay, they seem good. I'll play that.
Yeah.
And I have moved off of them. What about you, Docs?
For me, it goes back to that early college LARP. They were trying to round out the clans, and I wanted to do something that would have really fun and weird costuming, and they wouldn't let me play a Naga. And turned out it's because there was another woman there who did a much better Naga costume than I could have dreamed of. But they said, you want to do something weird? How about you make yourself into a tattooed monk?
Nice.
So I did that, and as LARP went on going, I started actually getting into the history behind it. I started reading the Tao Te Ching. I was practicing martial arts at the time, and I really liked the connections there. And it actually was very therapeutic to escape into this world where, by being in character, I was supposed to be seeking peace and calming myself. And I really enjoyed that. So when I got into the CCG, there was no question that I'd play dragon. Most of what I play in the RPG today is still dragon. And when the LCG launched, I was like, I don't care how good or bad they are, this is what I'm playing. The one thing that disappoints me is I really wanted to play monks, and I was not happy with where monks were when the game launched, so I went to dueling instead. So the fact that Arash is doing the monk deck today and I'm talking about dueling, it feels a little ironic to me.
Yes, that is a quite.
So dragon now, like we said, has two distinct deck builds. One of them is a monk-based deck that's largely or widely called Test, thanks to Anil. MD Mind Desire, who has been on Dragon for, you know, a very long time since the game started and was the quote unquote leader of the Dragon Clan that Adam was so snarkily referring to earlier, and did very well with it and has recently hopped off onto Phoenix. Anyway, he you know, the deck's called Test or Copy of Test, and it's the classic monk deck at this point for Dragon. So Arash, can you talk about that deck and like what does it do if for anyone who's unfamiliar, and you know, what makes that deck up?
Sure. So Test actually has gone through a lot of different changes as the meta like has evolved. But it, like, at the core of it has just basically been like dragon good stuff deck, right? It has all the good green cards in it. So like what types of questions do you have about it? Like, what do you want me to talk about?
So I guess the big thing would be like, if you were to describe it to a new player who walks into like, you know, the Carcosa Club and says, hey, I'm looking at playing L5R, I hear dragon's really fun. I hear there are two decks. What would you describe the current deck that you play as, whether we call it a monk deck or not? Like, I mean,
yeah. Okay. So like the core strategy of that deck has basically just been investing in characters. So you rely on the fact that your characters are above the curve, both in terms of stats and in terms of abilities, definitely in terms of abilities.
And you're talking dynasty here, right?
Yeah. Dynasty characters. And then the conflict is just basically built around making them shine. Right, and making them like stay and making them like perform better. And then you have a bunch of like smaller things that sort of like build tempo and like poke and sort of like gain you small incremental value, while like a bigger character, like these like bigger sort of towers that you have win the game for you.
Right. So you're looking to basically find in your dynasty purchase phase, right, the ability to get those big characters. So your big characters would be, and you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but like Mitsu, Yakuni, and like those are your two, like, you know, big ones.
No, I mean, like, right, Sugu is like a really important one.
Right, but I think, I mean, just to, as a ability to kind of have a dichotomy to the dueling deck, like Ratsuga's good no matter what. He's just a good character. But what you're looking for in the monk deck is you really want to be able to make a monk character come into play or apply the Seal of the Dragon to make that happen. Possible.
So like right. You basically want to find a 3 to 5 cost every turn, and like sort of make them into like semi towers.
In a tower, just so
oh yeah, sure. So a tower basically is a very strong character who has a bunch of like weapons on him, or like fans, or just like fine katanas or whatever, like pumping up his stats. And then he has a bunch of armor, which I mean, like, he has finger jade or like reprieve, or I guess those are really the only two.
And fate.
Yeah, you buy him with like 4 fate or 5 fate, and he like, because of the fact that every single turn they're doing something amazing, you just get a lot of return on investment on them. Yeah, and like a lot of times you're building, like you sort of do like a semi-wide strategy where you have just like a bunch of guys, all of whom are like pretty good. And then because the Dragon Stronghold makes any attachment basically worth +1/+1, you just have a bunch of like pump built in.
Right, and critically, like you mentioned, Reprieve, that deck splashes Crab almost mm-hmm. always. In order to be tested, kind of has to be Crab Splash. There are other
100%
variants.
I mean,
mostly just for Reprieve, right? So your big characters stick around longer.
Well, it originally started because of Pathfinder's Blade. But when Pathfinder's Blade was put on the RL, yeah, it's basically for Reprieve. Everything else doesn't matter. The Huruma Skirmishers were very nice and were there for a very long time. But now it's just basically just Reprieve. And the mountain doesn't fall.
Right. Yeah, there's a couple variants, but that's the core buildup.
Yeah.
Okay, so in contrast to that, the other deck that exists is one that is kind of recently come into existence, more or less, outside of the fringe Alex Jacobs players who've been on it since the beginning.
I am my own meta.
You are your own meta. And they exist mostly because of a new card that came out called Miyamoto Daisho. And I guess I'm not going to talk anymore about that, although this deck does need a name. We need a name for this deck. I want to be able to refer to this thing as a thing that's not the Miyamoto Daisho dueling deck, Dishonor deck, or whatever, because that's a pain in the butt. So everybody think about that, and maybe we can come up with some suggestions by the end of it. In the meantime, Alex, why don't you tell us about that deck, and how is it different than the classic monk deck, and what is it trying to do?
So I'm going to go off on a very slight tangent here. There's another player from England named Matthew Light, and he had a great interview after he won the Cork Cote in 2018. And he won with Scorpion. He said, playing Scorpion is a lot like playing Magic, by which he meant it was this very active deck. It relied very heavily on the conflict deck, playing lots of events and cards that directly change the game state. When I play the dueling deck, I always say, I'm not playing L5R, I'm playing Sentinels of the Multiverse. I'm doing this big engine building deck. So you take the Voltron strategy that the Dragon Monk deck uses, and you just crank that thing up to 11. So in the Dragon Monk, like you'll take a Togashi Yukuni, and you'll put Seal of the Dragon on him, and Reprieve to protect him, Finger of Jade to protect him, maybe a Daisha, maybe a Fine Katana or something. And he's got 3 or 4 attachments. He's a big, beefy guy. I will take a Miyamoto Ratsugu, and I will put Daimu's Favor on him so that I can pay for stuff. And then I'll give him 2 swords, and then I'll give him Way of the Dragon, and then I'll give him Duelist Training, and then I'll give him another Duelist Training, and then I'll stick on Above Question to protect all of this stuff. And I'll give him Tattooed Wanderer so he's covert. Like, I will take that character, and you'll have anywhere from 4 to 9 attachments. The most I've ever had is 12, though a bunch of those were also my opponent's debuffs on him. So it takes the Voltron strategy and just really cranks it up. The second thing it does is the Dragon Monk deck is very conflict dependent, because the card Void Fist requires you to play 2 cards before you get its effect off. So you need to have those cards to play pretty regularly. The dueling deck, the idea is that you build up a character, and then you stop drawing cards. And once you do that, it forces your opponent to stop drawing as well, or they get dishonored out. And so we're going to fight not with our conflict decks, but with our dynasty board. And I just have this massive, massive monster of a character around there. And there's not a whole lot on the board that can stand up to him for one turn, let alone for the rest of the game. When I was first learning from Eric, he gave me a couple key lessons, but a big one was that card draw wins games. And the inverse is obviously, if your opponent can't draw cards, they're going to have a very hard time winning a card game.
Right. So I guess the difference here is you still follow the same philosophy as far as building these towers, but your goal with those towers is quite different than the so-called quote unquote test/monk deck. Right. Your goal is to force them to be in conflicts and have to duel, whereas the test/monk deck is be in conflicts but lose them.
Well, that gets more into the different types of dueling decks. So there is a Dishonored dueling deck, which is the most powerful. And like you were saying before, that deck uses the card Miramoto Daisho. And Daisho has the ability, whoever your opponent cannot, during a duel, bid a 1 or 5. They have to bid 2, 3, or 4, which usually means that if you're able to leech honor from them, because if you're bidding 1, they're bidding 2, every duel, they're losing a pip of honor. And of course, this is a monster character, so you're winning the duel at the same time. And if I can run, so I will run that character with the Daisho, and I'll run 8 duels in one round, and I'll drop my opponent from a very comfortable, 10, 11 honor to 3, where they can't do anything. And there's a lot of ways you trick the duels in. And in this version of the deck, you don't really care about winning the duels or not. You just want to have them, because every time you do one, you're pinging your opponent and very quickly shutting down their deck. On the other hand, there's also a conquest style of the deck where you care a lot about the duels and about winning them, and you're using them for their effects. So the great thing about dueling is there are multiple builds for it. And the other thing that I think makes it very strong is that it's very easy to switch from Dishonor to Conquest. If your opponent starts overbidding on cards or trying to win the duels, they lose their honor very quickly, and you can almost instantly switch to Dishonoring them out. On the other hand, if they see the Dishonor game and they start low bidding, then all of a sudden they don't have cards, they can't afford to fight back in the duels, and the duel effects start going off, and again, you just start dominating over their board. So it's a very flexible deck when it fires.
Yep. And one of the big things that I see a lot, kind of side companion to Daisho, is the fact that they'll be on a keeper roll and they will have the new card Defend Your Honor, which is kind of like a linchpin, I feel like, in that deck, since the Daisho costs 2 and you only have 3 and there's a lot of attachment hate in this game. So you'll usually like drop that thing in the middle of a conflict and then they'll try and get rid of it, and then you'll duel them and they'll have to, lose honor, and they'll still lose. And, generally that's sort of how that plays out. Assuming that there are seeker builds for the Dishonor deck, Alex, can you talk to that a little bit?
Absolutely. Seeker build is actually pretty strong as well. And when I won the first time this deck won a tournament, it actually was with the seeker build variant. And the seeker build, you'd have less influence, so you're not going in as much on a lot of the Crane stuff that helps you Dishonor. Like, you don't have as many Iaijutsu Masters, you don't have as much armor through above question. But it gives you more reliable fate production, and again, it gives you more stuff to stick on the tower. I think one of my favorite cards that's underrated is Stone of Sorrows, and if you can get that going off in the Seeker build, it means your opponent doesn't have cards or honor, and all of a sudden they don't have fate either, which makes matching on characters a lot more difficult.
Huh. Interesting to hear you mention Stone of Sorrows in a good deck list, in your opinion.
The deck list that I published after winning Glen Burnie was called Stone Dueling 3.0. Because I've been testing that card for a while, and this was the third major version of the deck.
Wow.
Cool. I've never played that card. And I actually don't know what it does, so I'm going to look it up.
Stone of Sorrows is one of those obscure cards, which when it would hit the table, my opponent would have to stop the game and go, wait, I need to read this.
Is that the one that puts the fate on the rings?
No.
It does. So
your opponent cannot remove fate from the rings.
That's written in the stars.
Yeah.
Stone of Sorrows is the one that you can't take fate off rings if the person is standing.
Correct. Your opponent cannot remove Fate from the rings.
So they can't choose. So they can't choose which ring. Oh, effectively, they can't.
They can choose the Fate stays on the ring.
Oh, that's annoying.
Right. The Fate just rides around on the ring and lands.
Just like with Master Alchemist.
Yes.
Yes. So it was actually intended to be a combo with the Monk deck, I think, when it launched, and that never really took off.
Yeah.
And
it also costs two.
It costs two, so it's hard to make it pay for itself. But it shuts down your opponent. And the other great thing about it, the weakness that it had was not attachment hate. Like, I don't care if somebody lets go. Not attachment, because that's saving one of the attachments I care about for something else. But it was always the risk of it being stolen with Calling in Favors or Karada District.
I still think maybe Karada District, but like Calling in Favors on this card, I'd be pretty happy with someone doing that to me, because that's like a reprieve that they're not Calling in Favors or, I don't know, literally any other attachment. like, this is a very cute effect, but I don't think that it's, I don't know.
No, it was not competitive. It was when the deck fired, it fired very, very hard. But again, there were matches where if I see Karada out, like it's a dead card in my hand, because I can't put that. I can't spend two Fate to let my opponent steal it for one and turn the econ against me.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing with the dueling deck is that it also runs a restricted list card. You guys, and there's not like a standard. I guess Policy Debate is standard, right?
That's the one that most people seem to have agreed upon. Just because it's another duel. Again, if you're hamstring your opponent's hand, being able to go in and pick out that fight on that they've been saving the whole game, it's a very powerful effect.
I mean, it's just a really good card.
Yeah.
Hence why it's on the RL.
Yeah, a lot of people were using Miramoto's Fury when it first came out. It's the one I was using, because it just bought you time to build up your tower.
I don't think that is enough on swarmy strategies.
Yeah,
it doesn't stop Unicorn.
It doesn't stop Unicorn. It doesn't stop Lion with Ready for Battle. Doesn't stop Crab with Kuni Witch Hunter. Doesn't stop Phoenix with their 19 stands or whatever they're running these days.
Yeah, all the stands.
Yeah. And again, if it shows up late in game, it's a dead card. So the biggest weakness of the dueling deck is consistency. Are you getting the pieces you need in the right order? Are they coming out at the right time? And Fury was just so prone to misfiring and coming out late in the game that something like Policy Debate, where I don't care what part of the game we are in, I'm always happy to see that. That made a big difference.
Right. And then, so there's another variant that's popped up recently with the dueling deck, and that's with the Crab Splash for Watch Commanders. I've seen.
Oh, I played that deck this weekend.
You have? Yeah. So how did that go?
I played one game with it, and I think that I went a little OD on defending, and I didn't like switch to Conquest quick enough. But it's really fun. I mean, it's kind of a fun deck.
Right.
I think it'll be good with Phaidon.
I'm inclined to agree.
That's something that we're going to talk about in a little bit.
Like, I think that this deck is good, but it'll be like legitimately a good deck with Phaidon. And maybe one, if we get like one conflict card that's native to Dragon, that is a duel. It could be an attachment. It could be just an event. But then I think you turn that deck, and it becomes like kind of scary. But I think it's effective.
I think that deck is really taking the best of both worlds here. Like, you're getting the resilience of the deck, along with the ability to swing on or with the dueling deck, and we've seen a couple of variations, but the people who are testing it, they're getting some really good results out of it.
So do we have someone who? So I know it did well, or a version of this deck did well in the Paris Côté recently. So is that version of that deck sort of where people are landing on right now for like what you're talking about, Alex? Or like, can we point somebody to a well known published deck list that we can say this is what we're talking about here?
Yeah, so actually, if you go into the Imperial Advisor and you look up Ralph P, he goes by Togashi Daigo in the Discord. He's the pilot of that deck, and he actually has made a couple of changes to it, which he's like very willing to share with you. I don't have an exact list to his like deck list the way that I did to test, but the Imperial Advisor version hasn't changed much. I think the only thing he's added is Peasant's Advice.
Right, that's a cute effect. So we have a link to that. We'll try and link at least one of it. There's a lot of variants within the dueling deck. So we'll try and link as many of the distinct ones as we can in here.
Well, that's because it's still a developing archetype, right? Like, it's not fully formed yet the way that Test is or the way that the Phoenix deck is. People are still sort of, like, playing around with it, which is nice.
Those decks seem to have, here it is, and if you deviate, then that's on you.
Right.
But, so, which do you guys feel is the strongest dragon deck? Like, if you had to pick one, trying to be objective... Objective? Yes, objective about it. What do you think is the strongest?
With the knowledge of... the information we have a week before the new Unicorn pack drops.
Right.
Like, I mean, I don't know how much you guys have seen the spoilers there, but that's kind of...
I have trouble delineating which ones are the ones that are in the Unicorn pack and which ones are like an inheritance cycle.
Yeah, I agree. I'm just trying to give everybody a little bit, whether you know all those cards or not, I want to give people perspective. Like,
yeah, currently playing today, not upcoming.
So I think currently playing today, the Monk deck performs more consistently, and it is the better tournament deck because it's just a much more consistent deck.
I have to reluctantly agree. If I was going to a tournament today and my goal was to win the tournament, I would take the Monk deck.
Yeah.
If my goal was to just make the cut and have a good time, then I would feel very comfortable going with the Dueling deck.
I think that the Test, like copy of Test or whatever the fuck, has like a really hard time against Unicorn already. Because you just don't build it. You just don't build things fast enough a lot of the time. And by the time, because that deck needs like 3 turns to get its feet going. And like the first 2 turns, you're just sort of like poking and building up and like getting board presence and starting to become scary. And like you're just not using cards because they're all attachments or whatever. And then as soon as like one guy shows up, he just gets like, or she just gets all of it. And it's like, oh, fuck. Sorry, I'm cursing a lot.
That's okay. We're all grown-ups here. Sorry, people.
No, this is what everybody does against you when we see your good characters show up, though. Like, as a non-dragon player.
Like, yeah, you see, like, a Yokuni, and then all of a sudden it has a seal, and, like, a katana, and a fan, and it's honored, and it, like, you know, it's like, oh, okay, cool.
How do I noble sack that mofo?
And then it gets a reprieve, and then you calling in favors that, then I put a finger of jade down. Anyways, like, it's just... Right. A lot of things. But the problem is that it takes a really long time to build up. And usually, like, against most clans, especially clans that only have 2 conflicts, you can defend at least one of them really well for the first 2 turns. But with Unicorn, they are not only, like, you just can't defend aggressive. The military very well. So then they just get another military, which is insane.
All right. So we're actually crossing into another topic a little bit that I want to talk about with, like, good and bad matchups. So...
Oh, sorry. So basically what I'm saying, if Unicorn becomes a very big part of the meta, then I think that the dueling deck will probably be better because it defends better and it leeches them of honor much quicker.
Sorry. Were you just saying that the Unicorn deck is really hard for the dueling deck to deal with because it takes so long to set up?
No, the Test deck. Sorry. I have a tendency to ramble.
Okay. Okay. So the Test...
The Monk deck, the Test deck, whatever, has a really hard time dealing with the Unicorn deck. I think that the dueling deck also doesn't have a great matchup against Unicorn, but I think that it's better because they can defend faster, essentially, because they're just geared towards defending.
I think I agree with that as well.
I'd agree with that, though I'd also point out all the dragon decks have had a harder time with Unicorn lately due to the who's the Shinjo that they drop to negate a province break effect.
Oh, Ambusher.
Yeah.
That guy's awful.
Yeah. So much of the Voltron decks relied on having provinces with on-break effects, because you expect to lose your provinces. That's fine. They're your hit points, basically. But you want your opponent to really have to bleed to go through it. And when they can just drop that Shinjo Ambusher and negate the cost of it, then that let it burn, trade province for a province strategy becomes a lot harder to pull off.
Yeah, it's really just upholding. You really like, it's just like ice and runner, right? Like, you want the runner to like pay a price, and they just like bypass it, and it's awful.
Yeah, I think Ambusher in general has just been, I actually think it's a meta-changing card at this point.
It is, because I'm starting to test Vassal Fields.
Yeah, I'm running Vassal Fields.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah. In my most recent like Amateur Cup deck, I'm running Vassal Fields, because that's just, it hurts so bad when they do that to you.
Yeah. It sucks because Vassal Fields is just inferior to upholding authority.
But more consistent, right? Yeah, it's like spike. Do you want spikes, higher spikes, or lower consistent, you know, something?
Although I did get up holding off once against a unicorn player, and he lost 3 cav reserves.
Ooh.
It made me feel so good.
That hurts.
So very good.
Every unicorn player out there just cringed. I mean, I just cringed. I'm a unicorn player. So since we're actually talking about it, it was the next topic anyway. What are the hardest matchups? Do you guys feel like unicorn is the hardest matchup?
I think for the dueling deck, probably Phoenix is the hardest matchup still.
Absolutely, by a wide margin.
Yeah, because you guys just don't know. You just don't have an answer to 5 fires.
Well, no answer to 5 fires. They have the let goes. They have the tattooed wanders. They have all the stands. So if I'm going all in on one Voltron character.
Although they don't use tattooed wanders as often anymore. Like Phoenix Test has Ancient Masters.
No, but that was just a piece of it. Between the let goes and Mia Mystics, they've got, and the fact they're also running Fire Elemental Guard now, like they can just really sack you after the die shows.
Sorry, can you that one is super obscure. Can you fill everybody in on Fire Elemental Guard?
Fire Elemental Guard was another card I want to say from Imperial. It was a sleeper card that no one's really seen in a while.
I think it was in the Phoenix plant.
Oh, was it in Phoenix pack? Okay.
Yeah.
It's 4 fate for a 4/2 Bushi that has the build has action. If you have played 3 spells in this during this conflict, you choose and discard an attachment.
Yeah.
So it's reusable attachment hate, and Phoenix don't have a lot of trouble playing 3 spells during a conflict.
Before the RL was in place, a lot of people used Fire Elemental Guard because you could charge them in. And then use 3 spells and then just like get rid of a Cloud Demind. And that was really annoying. But after Charge like left the deck, they just stopped using him because he's 4 cost. In Anil's latest deck for Paris, he had Fire Elemental Guard in them though. They're actually pretty useful. I mean, they help the mirror. They really help with getting away like clouds and like fingers and stuff like that.
So, but between all the attachment hate and 5 fires, like you just can't build up your big character. And even if you do pull it off, they're in one character, they're in one conflict, and then Phoenix can be in 3 other conflicts that round without breaking a sweat.
Yeah, definitely.
So it literally runs circles around you.
I've seen a couple of kind of pretty bad answers to 5 fires in the Phoenix matchup in those dueling decks, and that comes in either the form of Good Omen, which is a little better because you have Miramoto Daisho, so it's more consistently on. You can just hold those. Hopefully you're ending the turn with, you know, the bid dials in your favor for that. And then what's the other one? Being and Becoming is another one. But that, you need the character to be
Being
standing.
Being and Becoming kind of sucks, but yeah.
Yeah, but like if they 5 fires you early in a turn and you're not bowed yet, you can then pull Fate Offerings if it exists. It's, like I said, not great answers, but they are answers. And then this Watch Commander deck, obviously just, I think they just have Reprieve.
Splashes,
right?
Reprieve, yeah.
But even then, it's only a couple of turns, right, that you're going to be outlasting them for. So hopefully it's long enough.
Again, when you can bleed 5 or 6 on, or in some cases 10 or 12 on, last that much longer.
Yeah.
Right.
Again, the Monk deck has been running Ancient Masters and Censure. And you just dig for Censure, go for Favor, and then don't use a Censure because of Tadaka until it's either too late or, and like 5 fires isn't going to do enough, or like they 5 fires into you without Favor. But that makes you do like stupid things, like you have to put like Cloud the Mind on Gisei Toshi in the draw phase, or you have to like, I don't know, stuff like that. That makes it like not incredibly reliable as a win condition.
They're very awkward play arounds.
They really are.
So, okay, so Phoenix, Unicorn's obviously pretty hard for us right now. Are there any other matchups that are, like, particularly difficult for Dragon at the moment?
No.
I mean,
Crab.
Definitely for the dueling deck, the combination of Karada District plus Way of the Crab, which, so you can lose the attachments and you can very easily run if you don't play around it, can make it a very tough matchup. It's a little more draw-dependent than the other matchups are, since you need to get the cheap characters to play around Way of the Crab, and you need to also break provinces so that when Karada does show up, hopefully it only lasts one turn, and they have worse places to rebuild it. But it can be beaten. It's not as much of a shutdown as Phoenix is, but it is a tougher matchup.
Right, and Karada District, and what's the Phoenix one? The Phoenix
Kanjo
District. There's a handful of other like really big problem provinces that have been driving a couple of people to test out Peasant's Advice in this deck, like was mentioned earlier.
In the dueling deck. I don't think that deck that card makes it into the monk deck.
I have mostly only heard it in that build, but that's something that people are playing around with too. So we talked about bad matchups. What matchups are like Dragon does really well and maybe above the cut of the other, you know, like we have an advantage in?
With the monk deck, I've always found Scorpion to be a really good matchup.
Yes.
Especially
as a Scorpion player, yes, I agree.
Because like you already are running like, especially like City of the Open Hand, where they're just sort of playing sort of the like reactive game, our province lineup really like actively helps with that.
Right. We've gotten pretty far into this interview without mentioning our like most hateful province.
Right. Resto.
Resto. Restoration of balance.
Resto really, really like fucks Scorpion.
Do people not like that province?
I personally am a big fan.
I have actually, as a Scorpion player, while I think it is annoying, I have no issue with it. Like, it is
just play around.
Yeah, it's a play around, but like you just have to know it exists, right? Like that's.
I also think that it's like a respect issue. Like,
yeah.
A lot of times I find people get really, really caught up in how scared of Resto they are, and it like completely cripples their play style. And like other like really good players just sort of just aggressively look for it, and as soon as it's over, it's like fine.
Yeah, yeah. You have to play into
flip it as early as possible.
Right. I think that's been the most successful strategy I've seen against it. And when I am in a mirror match, I'm not a big fan of like, let me hold off and wait for them to, I'm going to play cards, whatever. I just turn when I want to find it, you know, so.
Well, I think the other issue people have with Resto is you get players that they'll have 15 cards in their hand and they'll keep bidding five when they haven't found it yet and they haven't flipped over their provinces. And that's one way of saying, do you really need four extra cards for this? Like, is 20 going to make a difference between that six compared to 16? And if those 15 cards are that you already have aren't helping you, then you have cards that you can get rid of already.
Right. And people do like really stupid things like they'll attack a province, it'll be shameful, they won't break it, and then so they'll attack it again to break it. And it's like, is a turn one break really that important? Like the other thing that you could have done right now is like look for another province. And if you have two safe provinces, then you're going to be good
right
for such a long time until like your hand stabilizes and restoration is not going to be a big deal.
Well, people don't want to get hit, have to deal with shameful a second turn. That one I understand.
I mean, okay, but it's easier to deal with shameful than resto.
But like, I'll see it against like Fertile Fields or Manicured Gardens, and that's when I'm really saying, no, go find something else.
Yeah, that's true.
So one thing that since we've been talking about all these two styles of decks that Dragon's running right now, I feel like is important for people who are playing against these decks. How do they know? Like, why are we not super overpowered? Because people can't tell what they're up against until it's too late. Do they need to like deal with honor more and focus on that, or try and attack us and break provinces, or you know, how do you tell what kind of a deck you're up against when you sit down across from a Dragon player?
Oh, yeah, it's super easy. Are they Seeker or Keeper?
Before you guys kind of answer, I also have another spin on this. Is like, even as a, because this is about Dragon players, like, this is a great question for helping people that are not Dragon players, but as a Dragon player, how do you hide what you're playing as a deck a little bit so that it makes it difficult for your opponent to figure out, are you doing dueling? Are you doing kind of more Conquest Monk deck style?
So I agree with Arash that the role is the tell right now, because the monk deck is Seeker. It will very, very, like, if it's Keeper, then maybe you're on, if you're not a dueling deck, maybe you're on like a Phoenix or Unicorn Splash just for funsies. But you know,
outside, we have like what, three weeks left of this current like role situation, right? It's like first week of April, so
yeah. But the Keeper deck will, yeah, that's actually a good point, because once we get Keeper of Water, I think Seeker of Void will still be the better province row, because I think currently Seeker of Void is the best province row. But Phaidon is very convincing, especially if Unicorn ends up being just like meta-defining.
I also think if we go Keeper of Water, the two decks actually grow very close together. And the issue I had with monks from that role player point of view was there wasn't really a monk deck. I still don't think there is. There's a dragon deck that uses monk tactics and uses a supporting strategy. And I think once you go Keeper of Water, it goes back a more unified clan deck that runs both dueling and the monk stuff as support, but it's not going to be defined purely by one or the other. And I actually think that creates a much more interesting line of play.
Yeah, that's true. I like that. That's a good description.
So for right now, it's what role are they? If they're Keeper, they're probably going to be on a dueling variant. And if they're Seeker, they're probably on the regular old deck, although you're not guaranteed, obviously.
And then you still get the kind of periphery decks. Like there's a Phoenix Dragon deck, there's a Unicorn Dragon deck.
Right.
So you could see either one. And I think you have to go in and you have to play it a little bit cautiously and focus on dragon, not on what specific cards they have. Wait till they start playing stuff.
But there are cards that are tells, right? Like Prudent Challenger is like usually in a dueling deck and not in a monk deck. Togashi Mendicant is never in anything but the monk deck.
Granted.
Yeah, there's a handful. Like
it doesn't really even want to be in, like, we don't want him in the monk deck, but whatever.
Right. Shomon is more or less.
Shomon, I've seen in both decks, and I run Shomon.
But more frequently in the dueling one, right? These little things will add up. You'll, in that first turn, maybe, you know, kind of go, okay, so like 75% chance this is a dueling deck, you know?
Right. I mean, like, the biggest tell is, do they have Proving Grounds? Or is that an Imperial Storehouse? Because if they have Proving Grounds, then they're 100% a dueling.
Yeah, but like if that first turn, like you flip over and it's a Doom Shugenja and a Gasha Swordsmith and Favorable Grounds, like you don't know what that is. But your first turn, you're not trying to win the game anyway. You should be trying to get information. Like your first turn, as is often said, is not about breaking provinces. Is about
the
seeing
province row is setting. Different for the two. Like the dueling deck runs before the throne.
True.
And you guys also run, I guess that's the only one that's different, right?
I miss
before people were very familiar with the deck. Like I get so many comments on, what is this card? Who the hell runs this? And why is it beating me?
Before the Throne can be nice sometimes. So are there any cool clan tricks that like new dragon players won't be aware of? Like a brand new person sits down to a Crane deck, a Crane player will be able to show them that there's this combination with Steward of Law and For Shame that is like, oh, cool, because they can't dishonor, right? Do we have anything like that?
I think that there's always like a side game going on where you're trying to copy, make the weirdest use of Yukuni's power that you can while still keeping it effective. So I think that's like I don't know if that's a cool trick, but that's like definitely something that is definitely one of the fun aspects of playing Dragon.
That's a good point that your clan champion can pretty much do anything any other character in the game can do.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's always like a, which weird thing do I want to do now? Which is fun.
It's like very Scorpion of you.
Yeah, that's a fun one. And a lot of players will forget that Yukuni, I did forget for a long time that Yukuni only copies triggered abilities. So they'll be worried about like playing magistrates or something. Or at least,
you know what's great is when somebody does that and you have a Maya Mystic in play, you play Haunty and you have to tell them to choose a Maya Mystic as the action they're going to copy. That's a lot of fun.
One thing that I heard recently in Dragon Chat was the combination of Katsuki Shomon and Peasant's Advice to like use Peasant's Advice, direct to her, stand her back up, and get a second attack with her while using Peasant's Advice. It's a pretty nice little combination, but pretty fringe right now.
I thought that was really cute. I like that.
I really want to try it.
The one that I always found surprised people is Way of the Dragon, which lets you use a triggered ability an extra time. So for example, I will have some very crucial duel that my opponent is like, I can't let him win this, can't let him win it, and they'll throw their honor against it. I'll bid one. And then I'll throw Way of the Dragon on the duelist and get to do it again. And they don't have any honor anymore, and I'm stronger in the duel.
Right.
A lot of people didn't understand that Way of the Dragon doubles all other abilities the character has. So if you have duelist training, you get two duels off of it. My favorite combo I ever pulled off of it was I was playing a Scorpion opponent, and he had Illustrious Plagiarist out. I use Yukuni to copy the Illustrious Plagiarist, which copies an event from the discard pile. Then use the copy ability to copy Fate Worse Than Death. So that's fun. I get a use out of that. Then I play Way of the Dragon. So I got a second use of the copied Way of the Fate Worse Than Death. And I could copy Fate Worse Than Death a second time and use both of those two times. So I had four Fate Worse Than Deaths that round for two.
Wait, no. You can't use the Yukuni copy ability twice, can you?
I can't use the copy ability, but I can use the copied ability.
Twice, only two times.
Yes, but then each of the copied abilities could also be used twice.
Okay.
That's and stupid. I love that because you copy the Illustrious Plagiarist, which is not only like so cheeky in the fact that it doesn't have to pay the cost, but the like Boshigunjas and like neither is running like any sort of against the waves probably.
Did they get rid of the ability to copy Shadow Adept or Adept of Shadows?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because for a while you could do that.
You could hop back on your hand and then you could play him on demand whenever you wanted.
And then he had to, in order to discard cards at that point, the opponent had to like roll a dice or some shit.
Yeah, because
you had to choose another more random method of choosing a random card because they knew which one Yukuni was.
Right, because the two different card backs. So yeah, the Way of the Dragon is a card that it's just so much fun to play, and it's expensive, but man, it is good when you need it sometimes. So yeah. I don't know. I'm a big proponent of, like, I've mostly been playing test, but I like just having one of those. I like Kazue.
Yeah,
like one of those. It's never really worked out great, but occasionally, like, you know, it's this thing, non-competitive for fun play. You're like, aha, I get to do all this.
I mean, Kazue is never bad. At the end of the day, she's still a 3-3 body. Even if you play her as a conflict character, it's usually fine. I've had games with 1x Kazue in them. Yeah. Like, I like her a lot.
She's good. Jasper Mangus, who won one of the two Adepticon. No, he didn't win, but he was top
5. At the,
He went 6-0 in the Swiss. He was running test, but with a Kazue in it, so she gets used.
He always runs a Kazue in every deck that he builds. Like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the deck is, as long as it's dragon, right? Obviously, in non-dragon, he doesn't. But every single deck of his has 1x Kazue.
I like Jasper.
All right,
Jasper.
I got a question here.
All right.
So, this is a question that I'm not going to have you answer, but if you want to answer it after my real question, you can. So, why doesn't Dragon get any good spoilers? But in all seriousness, what you are looking at here is Dragon isn't getting a clan back until what the rumors are saying is until like November timeframe, so right before Worlds, so probably not legal there.
Right.
After Worlds, Tyler has confirmed that all the packs will be out before Worlds except for Dragon.
Is it not going to be out before Worlds, or is it just not going to be legal for Worlds? I thought it wasn't going to be legal for Worlds, which would be infuriating.
It is, but so kind of my question is, so that the spoilers joke is its own kind of like question, but so you guys can answer that along with this. But you guys are the first, Dragon is the first clan that we're doing two co-hosts here on, right? You know, we have two different archetypes, two deck types that are in play. Do you think that is something that is unique? Because the only other clan that I can think of that has that right now is Scorpion, which we haven't done a kind of clans focused discussion on. So right now, is Dragon in an interesting place? Because you guys do have not only two archetypes, but you also have kind of a spectrum, right? Between those two archetypes, which you guys have kind of talked about a little bit during this discussion, where they kind of flow in between. So you have a scale on how much dueling, how much kind of monk / conquest you want to do. So
I don't think that's completely true. I mean, I think that there's two Crane decks, right? There's Scorpion Splash and then there's Dragon Splash.
I don't know about that.
And Unicorn Splash.
I don't know.
Oh yeah, and Unicorn Splash.
You're right, those decks exist, but I still think if you're walking up to a tournament, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe Dragon has the same problem. But what I'm saying is I think Dragon right now has at least an interesting spectrum of decks, whereas Crane has one that is really good and one that is kind of like okay to bring.
I just want to jump in here for a minute. So first off, we did get spoilers. Every character we saw previewed as a Yukuni target, so we were spoiled with everyone else.
That's true.
Okay, right. Fair enough.
Second, the idea of there being different deck types and really comes down to what you how strong a deck needs to be for you to feel as viable. If your goal again is to win a Kote, there's pretty much only one option for each clan. But if your goal is to anywhere from have a good time to have a winning record to make the cut, most clans can field at least two decks.
I So I disagree. I think that Scorpion has two viable Kote winning.
Yeah, I mean,
archetypes.
Scorpion, but that's because well, they're two different.
That's exactly right? My point of my question. Yes. So maybe just be clear here. Scorpion got a clan pack. We have two strongholds. We have two very different archetypes. We're the only clan that I think has that clear cut. I think Dragon is the other one without having a clan pack that has a different stronghold with a different kind of like directed archetype that naturally got the difference in decks. And that's kind of what I was trying to get at there.
But I think what Alex is saying is that even with that being said, it is like very clear that if you go to a tournament and you're expecting to do well, the deck you should probably use is the Monk deck.
Absolutely.
And that's not even like trying to like disrespect the dueling deck. I think it is a good deck. But like just because of Phoenix being a thing, I don't think that the dual deck is viable. Because you really don't have an answer to that.
It comes down to your definition of viable. If your definition means capable of winning the tournament or likely to win the tournament, I agree.
Well, yeah, that's what I meant.
I would still take this to a Kote with the goal of making the cut. I just would not expect to make it out of the top 16.
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely... I mean, like Ralph did, right? Like, he went 5-1 with it at Paris. And obviously... And I think there was a guy at Adepticon who was running the Watch Commander list, and he also made the cut, but lost in, like, top 8 or some shit. Yeah, I mean, like, you definitely can make the cut. It's just, like, how you do in day 2.
Well, I think that BM is very contingent on each player, too. What they're there for and what they want to get out of the game. Like some players I know are very kind of, some of the Dragon players are a little bitter that Anil jumped clans. He was very clear, like his purpose in this game is for this to be a competitive experience for him. And if your goal is to go out there and have that uber competitive experience, this is a great game for that. If your goal is to go out there and say, you know what, I rather like playing with my dueling cards, or I rather like my Phoenix Splash, then you can still go out. You can do pretty well. Like, I think there was, I know there's at least one Elemental Championship that was a final between a Phoenix Dragon Splash and a Dragon Phoenix Splash. So these decks are playable. It is just a question of what scale, and are you okay with going out there saying, you know what, I'm not going to make the finals. I'm okay with top 16. I'm okay with just having a winning record and my participation prizes. Or I'm okay with getting shut out, but I like going out and hanging out with my friends.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that, like, L5R player skill matters a lot, and what you're, like, comfortable matters a lot. So I think that if you, like, some people just naturally gravitate towards, like, the dueling deck, right? And if, then that'll, like, end up doing better for you if you're comfortable with it and you know how to use it, than, like, awkwardly switching to the Monk deck will.
I completely agree with that. On the Jade Throne podcast, one of my favorite episodes, episode 41, I have this memorized. Shay was talking with Killian, and one of the things he said was, if you understand that your brain is really geared towards a certain play style, that is what makes sense to you. It is, you understand the connections for it. Even if that's not a tier 1 deck, if that's a tier 2 deck, but you are just naturally adept at that, focus on developing those talents rather than trying to force yourself into something that is going to be an awkward fit for you.
Right, which is why Lion is able to win tournaments, right? Because it's just like you're good with this, like you're able to use this well. And like,
backhanded compliment.
No, it's true. I'm glad that both of you are saying that, because I think that is true in this game. I think a lot of times we get a little bit short-sighted as players, and even really community members, in like saying this is the best thing. But what you guys are saying is good players do well at events. If you go to an event and you play something you know and you want to play, you can do well. That's what's really good about this game.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's 100% true. Sorry, I had something, but I completely forgot what I was going to say.
That's okay. So let's
say yes.
Let's hop to that next question. What, Arash, what's your favorite card?
In like all of L5R?
Let's go Dragon or neutral card that you might play in the Dragon deck.
Okay, so actually my favorite card is Policy Debate. I really like Policy Debate.
That's weird.
It is, yeah, weird. I have this like obsession with knowing what my opponent has that could possibly make me lose the game. I can't describe it. I like that card a lot.
Most people hate that card, is why I say it's weird. I'm sorry, I don't want to throw shade on your favorite card.
Oh no, it's fine. those people play Unicorn.
And they walk around with three cavalry reserves in their hand. And
yeah. By in that same vein, I also really like Katsuki Investigator. I think Katsuki Investigator more so than any other like non-unique is like my favorite. Broken. Non-unique. And yes. Yeah. It is unequivocally too good. Which is what makes it so wonderful. And I also really like, I don't know, I like copying weird shit with Yukuni.
Yukuni's good.
It makes me happy.
What about you, Alex?
My favorite card is probably, unsurprisingly, Duelist Training. I thought from core that it was the most underrated card in the game. Not the best, but definitely unappreciated. And again, like I talked about building up that Miramoto Ratsugu Tower with a bunch of swords and other stuff. And my opponent would look so smug dropping a Cloud of the Mind on him. And then I go just play Duelist Training and go, okay, now what? He's still going to win the conflict and bow at your guy, and there's nothing you can do about it. So I just love the flexibility that it offers.
So what's the most common mistake that you'll see a new Dragon player making when they start playing the clan?
I think that the big things that I notice Dragon players in specific doing that like aggravates me is firstly like improper fate management. With the Monk deck, you have nothing that costs more than one. And in fact, I think you only have 19 cards that cost one, and the rest of them are just zeros. The majority of our money goes towards our characters and making them awesome and having enough fate to go from one phase into the next phase with like 12 or 14 or however many fate. So you can just, as soon as you get like a bomb dynasty phase, having enough money to just buy all of it, right? And a lot of times it feels as though you're just sort of like waiting and like defending and like poking whatever until you get like those really nice dynasty characters. And a lot of times with newer players, they tend to do that wrong. They tend to invest a little bit too much early, like use attachments early, use like all these different like reprise and fingers of jades and things that aren't really important early. And then when they get their like really cool character, not having enough armor or having enough attachments, or just like not recognizing like this is the turn that I forfeit this thing, or this is the turn where I like buy five fate for it. Or like a lot of times you'll see players like they're in the end game, like there's like three provinces broken on either side and they're still putting like four fate on the Ratsugu. And it's like at this point you could have put two fate on Ratsugu and it would have been fine. So I don't know. Like those like little small like fate management things really
annoy me. So right there, you mean specifically because the game is about to end, so why put the fate on a character that's not gonna last?
Right. Like you only need this character for maximum two turns. Right, like if it doesn't end this turn, then it's going to end next turn.
One way or another, it's going to end. You're either going to win or lose, but...
Yeah, that's a very good subtlety. I just want to make sure that people kind of caught that, because it is important. I think that happens in a lot of games, regardless of clan, that we're on each other's strongholds. You don't need to put a ton of fate in a character, because the game's not going to last.
Yeah, like one for a water ring, you know, at the minimum.
To expand on that, I think a lot of new players misunderstand the nature of the game because it looks like a card game or it looks like a war game, and in reality, it's a resource management game.
Yeah.
And you make it sound very exciting.
Oh, I know. I tell new players, if you are looking for a game where you can just lie awake at night in bed thinking about honor tokens, boy, do I have a game for you.
And a clan.
And that's why no one wants to play off my bar. No.
You have to understand the pieces, and there really are a lot of resources here. Characters, fate, honor, cards, tempo, like there's a lot of different pieces. And the way most decks win is they pick one or two of those resources that they can attack their opponent on. And with a Conquest deck, that's very visible because they're attacking your provinces. With a Dishonored deck, is very visible because they're attacking your honor. But the tactics they imply by that are attacking fate, they're attacking characters, they're attacking your hand. And like Arash said, if you don't learn how to manage your resources, you're going to get shut out and you're not going to understand why you lost. All you're going to know is that by turn three, you're looking at your opponent. They have a lot more cards than you do. They have a board with three or four strong built-up honored characters, and you're scrambling to put a bunch of one cost in to hold off their horde. And each turn, you get further and further behind. That's because you didn't play the resources right. I'll say as far as the dueling deck goes, the mistakes I see most people make is they're trying to go in with the same resource attitude that they had with test. They're trying to still play it the same way. And the dueling deck is a very expensive deck, so you have to manage your fate very differently. And you have to also have the courage, you have to have the discipline to play with no cards in hand, to winnow, to say, my opponent's up on cards with, but every conflict, they're spending it. My guys stay just as strong. I'm going to win this in the long term. So you have to have the courage to not panic when that happens.
Right, you just have to do a lot of incremental losses until you're no longer ever losing.
So new players take note. This has gone pretty long. I think we're about an hour and a half now. So one thing before we go, first of all, I wanted to thank you both for sitting with us and talking about this and, having wait a second, is hubris, what is hubris? Hubris is the bad thing, right?
Hubris is definitely the bad thing.
No, what's the other thing? Being humble enough at least to share the spotlight here.
Humility?
Humility, thank you. Not the hubris would have been.
I'm so good at vocabulary.
Yeah. I'm usually pretty good with it, except when I have a microphone in front of me.
Or making fun of other podcasters.
Do I do that a lot?
You've done it once on this very show. It was good.
I pointed out.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, Chris said something and I corrected his whatever. Anyway, so thanks for joining us. Before we go, I wanted to ask either of you if you have any good shout outs to resources that other Dragon players, an aspiring Dragon player could use to get better besides just playing games, because that seems to be the generic answer. What do I do to get better? Play a bunch of games, and that is good advice. Is there anything else that'll help them get there a little faster that you guys know of?
I would say just get yourself into the culture and community. Start listening to a bunch of the podcasts. Meek and Foreman, obviously, plug for this thing that we're on. Jade Throne is very good. I think Sixth Ring is one of my favorites. Also, I run the RPG podcast from them. I would also strongly recommend joining your clan's Discord. The Dragon Discord right now is a very positive place. People are experimenting. They're giving good feedback. It's very innovative. It's very encouraging. So if you're looking for a community, this is a great community to be in. And finally, Imperial Advisor is one of the few places that I'm writing about the game right now. I have the Dueling article up there. I also have another article for new players about mindset. I'm going to put the link in for that. But they have a whole section of articles specifically for new players that I would recommend.
Awesome. One thing I want to mention for us, I'm going to do a little self promotion here. I've been recording videos regularly for our YouTube channel. And last night I recorded a game where I had Ian fight a Scorpion Hanamoto sitting over my shoulder and playing the game with me and giving me advice against a crane deck. And if this kind of thing existed while I was playing my first 100 or so games, I would have loved to have watched it. So hopefully it's not unbearable because it's kind of long, but I would recommend going to at least watch a few minutes of that if you have the time. We're going to try and do more of those. Arash has actually said that he was willing to do the same thing, so maybe we'll try a unicorn game or something, and we're in general, we're going to try and do more of those videos where maybe one of us who doesn't play Lion might have a good Lion player sit over our shoulders and help us pilot that deck, so you get to hear the decision making out loud and explain to another person, because it's easy for me to sit there I want this because of that and this or the other thing pretty quickly, but if I'm sitting there going wait, why, it might slow them down and they break it down a little better. So hopefully that's helpful for people. It's another thing. We're going to have a lot. We're going to try and fit in all these links. But at the very least, maybe we'll put in a Reddit post or something.
So I actually watched 40 minutes of that this morning before I had to do something. And it was actually really helpful. I thought it was Ian. Yes, it's long, but Ian and you had really good conversations, and there's several critical moments that I thought were pretty well thought out, and you guys illuminated thinking really well.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I thought it was really cool. Yeah, I actually think that the Meek and Foreman in general has been really good. I find that the thing that helps me the most is watching the Discord League games. I actually really love watching those, especially when you have really good hosts on. Because I think that a lot of times you just need to see high-level play in order to understand sort of the subtleties of the game, and I think that makes you better. And it sort of illuminates your thinking in ways. So I find that that's really helpful, and I really like that.
If you're a new player and you're not sure what he's referring to, a lot of the high-level games in the Discord League are streamed. with a commentator who analyzes the lines of play, gives their own thoughts about it. So if you're not sure why other players are doing things, it's a great way to get that insight.
Yeah. I also feel as though it would be remiss, given the fact that I play still copy of Test, to not say that you should probably watch Anil playing the deck. He has like a very unique way of playing, and I don't think that I can, like, I don't think that you should like 100% replicate it, but there are like in his YouTube channel, like, and it's like a couple cycles old or whatever, there are a couple of videos of him playing, and I think that the things that he says about the deck, like some of the core like fading strategies and stuff like that, still make a lot of sense and are like worthwhile looking at. Even though like some cards aren't out yet, although the deck hasn't really changed that much.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, I think that's going to wrap it up for us tonight. Thanks a lot for watching, everybody. Adam and Arash and Alex, thanks for sitting with us and talking with us again.
And thank you for having us.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Anytime. Guests are great. It's a lot of fun. So see you. God damn it. I can't remember the freaking outro. Adam is samurai seldom known as peasants. I'm gonna remember this shit one day.
This is good. I was waiting for you.
This is not scripted.
Like, this is gonna be so good.
I get nervous like when the episode is like ending. I'm like, oh shit, and I can't think of it. And I'm like, oh no, it's the stupid thing I can't do.
You've been listening to the Meek Informant. You can find us on the web at www.facebook.com/ The Meek Informant, and can subscribe to our podcast through Google's podcast app, Apple's podcast app via iTunes or Podbean at themeekinformant.podbean.com/feed.xml. Want to continue the conversation about today's topic or any of our other content? We can be reached via our Facebook page or email themeekinformant@gmail.com. We also have a Twitter account, @meekinformant. Our YouTube or Twitch accounts can also be found by searching for The Meek Informant. If you would like to help others find us, please consider writing a review on iTunes or wherever you subscribe to our show.
Thanks for listening, and remember, samurai seldom notice peasants. Peasants always notice samurai.